Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Good Monday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber, Sarah Eisen at Post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. Cramer has the morning off. Futures solid as global markets look for some de-escalation in the Middle East. But we're close to session highs of the morning as March retail sales crush estimates. Strongest control group in over a year. 10-year 4.6. Our roadmap begins with these geopolitical risks for stocks. Futures rallying on hopes that the conflict will not escalate further.
Plus, Tesla cuts reportedly set to lay off more than 10% of its staff globally. CEO Elon Musk saying the company's looking for cost reductions and increased productivity.
And financials in focus again. Goldman Sachs topping first quarter estimates fueled by trading and investment banking.
Begin by kicking off a new week for the markets. Geopolitics obviously on the front burner, guys. We're watching some of the risk premium in oil back below 85. Brent, I think, off of 90 once again. But what an eventful weekend.
I think some people might be surprised to come in and see oil prices lower after the events of the weekend. I'm just going through some of the research. Eurasia Group, which is a big commentator on geopolitics that Wall Street likes to read, says the size and scale of the assault by Iran is greater than Eurasia Group anticipated. But, you know, there is hope, as you say, Carl, and potentially some signs that we might have a diplomatic sort of response by this. It's certainly what the U.S. is encouraging. Unclear what Israel's going to do. Obviously, the next few hours and days will be decisive because Wall Street's trying to figure out, is there going to be an escalation of this conflict that would jeopardize oil supply, right? When it comes to Iran, one of the biggest producers, that is always the question. And it's interesting to see oil prices down when you might think coming out of the weekend that there are at least greater odds of a bigger escalation in the conflict. And yet,
if you were watching Saturday night, you certainly would not have anticipated, I think, that the futures would be looking the way they are right now. Obviously, you might not have at that point expected that 99%+ of the cruise missiles, the ballistic missiles and the drones that were launched against Israel would have been intercepted. That said, to your point, Sarah, the question is, what is the response going to be? We don't know.
We don't know.
And the market seems to at least believe or hope, one would expect, that it will be a muted response of some kind, not lead to a hot war, because if that were the case, you'd probably expect to see a different picture for the market open, not to mention, to your point, oil prices.
I mean, it does come against a very different backdrop, some are making the point, than, say, Ukraine on the onset of that. First of all, it's a completely different conflict and war, but the backdrop is different because that was right as the Fed was raising rates, on the precipice of raising rates in one of the fastest hiking cycles in history. And as Tom Lee, who we're going to talk about later, a Fundstrat, points out, and he's in the buy the dip camp, that things like, you know, the deleveraging, it was in a very different position in terms of margin debt with much higher levels than we are now. And then you look, get into questions, Carl, about even if oil prices do go higher, if this gets worse, what's that going to mean for inflation? What's that going to mean for a Fed that we assume the next move is going to be a cut? Maybe that cut gets pushed further out. That was what last week's sell-off in the market was all about. And the view is, I mean, High Frequency Economics published on this over the weekend, it'll affect headline inflation, but not core inflation, which is what the Fed is really looking at. And the Fed doesn't have control over oil prices. Now, you could argue doesn't have control over insurance, right? Car insurance right, either, which is one of the culprits of these higher inflation readings. But that's one view as well.
Yeah. Meantime, the discussion continues about how less intensive, oil intensive, energy intensive the U.S. economy is. Apollo with a nice chart today from Torsten Slok, once again reiterating U.S. is the biggest oil supplier in the world. And in fact, this Wall Street Journal poll calling the U.S. economy the envy of the world is a lot of forecasts get lifted. Retail sales, of course, we mentioned a moment ago, 0.7, core 1.1. We were looking for 0.5. February revised higher?
February revised higher is key, because remember when we got the February number, we were all wondering, why isn't this stronger? January was weak. This was supposed to be a bigger give back. So the higher February bodes well. I would, the one caveat with these numbers is they're not inflation adjusted. So they do incorporate higher prices that people are paying for things. But what was the CPI rate in March? 0.4%. And so what was retail sales? 0.7%. There's still a gap there of spending where Americans are taking the price increases and they continue to spend. Online sales were particularly strong in this report. There's still lots of weak spots like furnishing and others. But between the higher gas prices we're paying, and it's not just gas. You saw it across the board. Services are still strong. The restaurant spending was still on fire. It does bode well for the consumer.
4.6 on the 10-year, Sarah.
4.6 on the 10-year.
What do we got coming up auction-wise? Anything we should be thinking about?
We're paying closer attention to these auctions. Last week was the big one. There'll be more. I mean, the Treasury has like a little under $400 billion
auction in May. Aren't we, again, getting their plan on maturities?
Refunding on announcements.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to. That's a quarterly situation.
Okay.
So,
right.
Yeah. The problem is we worry about these debt levels and these auction sizes when the Federal Reserve is not going to be imminently cutting rates. And that's been the story. And it makes sense, right? Because that drives up a huge cost for the U.S. government when it has to pay these higher interest rates,
right,
to finance the debt.
Without a doubt. That said, your favorite, the U.S. dollar, has
surged.
Been very strong, as you might expect, given the rate picture in Japan and in Europe is different.
Everywhere around the world. So what's so interesting is last week there was a big backup in yields and U.S. rates went up on this idea that the Fed isn't going to be in a rush, maybe not even able to cut rates this year, one, two. But other bonds yields went down in Europe and Canada. And we heard from the Canadian Central Bank last week and the European Central Bank, and they both were a little dovish because their inflation rates are not flaring back up. Maybe they're not putting as much fiscal stimulus into their economy like we are, and their economies haven't held up as much, and so they can cut sooner, which just means strong dollar, strong dollar, strong dollar. This is the IMF week. This is the week where all the central bankers and all the finance ministers come from around the world, and when you have a dollar yen pushing 154, which is considered super strong dollar, very weak yen, you start to worry about sort of the fragility in financial markets and destabilization and currency interventions. We've got the perfect guest tomorrow, Christine Lagarde, the head of the ECB, will be on this show right after her meeting last week to talk about the global setup and, of course, what she's going to do next.
Yeah, we got Ollie Wren of the ECB out today saying June still in play. I can't wait to hear what Lagarde tells you tomorrow.
June she did not change that script in last week's meeting. Importantly, given the Fed members who have come out, and there's going to be a lot more Fed speak today and this week, they have reiterated the message, David, that they don't need to be in a hurry.
Right. No hurry.
To cut.
All right. Well, we're in a hurry here. Let's move on to Goldman Sachs this morning. Shares are up in the pre-market. This beat was a good one, helped by strength in investment banking, trading. Let me go through just a quick take on some of the notes that have been released by analysts in the last few moments. Jefferies, First Take, very strong, specifically total revenues, $1.3 billion above consensus. All banking segments were above expectations. Wells Fargo, Mike Mayo, aided by strong M&A, number one, underwriting complemented by record fixed income, currency, and commodity financing. Second highest equity financing, far ahead of peers, especially in the investment bank. And for its part, what else do I have? Evercore ISI. Great start to the year, and it's not all cyclical. Straight up strong quarter led by better investment banking and higher trading. So that gives you a quick snapshot of at least the analysts who follow Goldman Sachs and their opinion of the quarter. Return on equity annualized 14.8%, 15.9% return on tangible equity, book value up as well, 2.4% year to date. And it does appear they took some share, which is important for Goldman. Looks like a very strong quarter, and as you might expect, the market is responding, at least as of now, positively.
That was the best ROE since first quarter of 2022.
Yeah.
So a pretty good measure there. And I think the relative performance and things like M&A and in trading compared to JP Morgan, we don't have Morgan Stanley yet. That would be a more direct comp, but looked better for Goldman Sachs. This is where they shine, right, in this environment. They're not a net interest margin bank. They're not a NIM bank like a J.P. Morgan is, which is why people were excited about J.P. Morgan on a more hawkish Fed. This is a bank that does better when the capital markets wakes up.
Absolutely. And there's some of the commentary that came along with the release in terms of strength of what they say is their world-class and interconnected franchises, the earnings power, executing on strategy, core strengths, the usual propaganda. No, I'm kidding.
On both sides, a lot of success here. Efficiency ratio near 61. OPEX, down 3, and revenue up 16?
And in fact, lower than expected equity and debt as well in terms of at least the performance in the IB. And so, for example, Mike Mayo at Wells saying that even adds to the quality of the beat. Again, it does appear they took share. To Sarah's point, of course, when you think about Goldman, you think about IPOs, you think about M&A advisory, you think about trading, it does appear that, not just appears, that they had a very strong quarter in all. And to your point, Sarah, may have taken market share, which is an important measure as well, because there had been, there have been some questions, at least in terms of where Goldman is these days. How is it competing and the like?
Well, they consolidated asset management, which is a point that got less attention, right, than the shrinking of the consumer. By the way, consumer less of a drag on this quarter.
Yes, so it gets smaller and smaller. It has less and less of an impact, right? Absolutely true. We're going to have more, Carl, as we move along. Of course, keep an eye on Goldman. We're still digesting as well. The market is sort of the Wells, Citi, and J.P. Morgan numbers that came out on Friday.
Yeah, worst day for JPM on earnings in about 20 years. And, of course, the corporate calendar is going to heat up. We'll stay on top of the news out of the Middle East and the tensions there. We'll get a former ambassador's perspective on that situation, plus get a report from the ground in that region. Take a look at the pre-market. Got some news on Tesla today with reports of some layoffs. Schwab's out. DJT down about 17% pre-market. Back in a minute.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Squawk on the Street. We turn back to Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend and concerns about rising geopolitical risks. Our next guest has spent extensive time in the Middle East working on policy and Israeli-Palestinian peace initiatives. Let's bring in former ambassador to Morocco, Mark Ginsburg, also a former White House Mideast advisor, currently president of Coalition for a Safer Web, a nonprofit that fights cyber terrorism and extremist incitement. Mr. Ambassador, good to have you with us. We understand Netanyahu likely meeting with his war cabinet today. What do you think they should be recommending to him?
I don't think they should be recommending a retaliation directly against Iran. I'm not an armchair general, but I'll play one for the time being. The problem is that the attack doesn't solve the fundamental problem that Israel faces from Iran's terror proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthi rebels. The attack by Iran doesn't change that equation. Israel still faces that problem. I would recommend that Israel focus its attention against Hezbollah. After all, it is the major threat to Israel at this point in time, other than Iran. And the United States could likely support a more concerted Israeli attack against Hezbollah, because after all, that is what the United States is there to do, support Israel and give it that ironclad guarantee, which Biden has taken off the table with respect to any retaliation against Iran.
So you think Hezbollah, and how does that, what would the reaction be? Describe what the dynamic would like between proxies and the direct relationship.
Well, given the fact that Iran fired its best shot against Israel the other night, there is very little that, in my judgment, Iran would be able to do to Hezbollah's rescue. Look, there's no doubt that Israel is caught in a quandary between the domestic extremist side of its government and the Israeli public. And yet at the same time, Carl, you know and I know that for almost two decades, there's been a shadow war waging against Iran by Israel. Assassinations, attacks on Iran's nuclear installations, and Israel has an enormous number of agents inside Iran, so we likely will see an acceleration of targeted attacks against senior Iranian officials, which the Israelis will deny.
You don't see Iran launching from its soil 350 drones, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles as an act of war they need to respond to?
Sarah, I couldn't agree more that this was an unprecedented attack. The first time that Iran directly attacked Israel. At the same time, while Israel has the capacity to hit back, I think the Netanyahu government does not probably want to lose the international support that it gained. After all, Israel diplomatically was in the hole quite a bit over the last few months over its humanitarian failures in Gaza. And yet, at the same time, you have a divided cabinet, a war cabinet, where Benny Gantz and the defense minister are pushing the government not to directly retaliate at this point in time and not to cause an expanded war, which the Biden administration has said it would not support. And Israel needs American support in the event of an expanded war. Israel would not have been able to intercept all of these missiles without American and allied support.
If they do choose to respond, let's say they try to blow up the drone manufacturing capability of Iran, what do you think happens then?
I think in the end, you probably have a much more concerted attack by Iran's proxies against Israel. The question is, from Hezbollah to Syria to Iraq, where the proxies are, let alone what we see from the Houthi rebels, David, you probably will see a more axis of resistance attack, retaliation against Israel. And it would be low caliber quality weapons that have already inflicted significant harm against Israelis in the north. Hezbollah has used anti-tank weapons to kill civilians. And that war, as you know, David, has been going on. There's going to have to be some equation that changes the straitjacket that Israel is in right now, and let alone the need for a hostage deal that would lead to a potential six-month ceasefire that could provide Israel the off-ramp from its current conflict with Hamas.
Yeah. Other interesting dynamic, of course, is public opinion within Iran appears to be somewhat dissatisfied with what some there would argue are expansionist stances regarding the Middle East. Mr. Ambassador, appreciate that very much. I'm sure we'll talk again, Ambassador
Ginsburg.
Sure,
thank you for having me.
A lot more to get to this morning, including Tesla and some new data from IDC on Apple iPhone sales. Take a look at the pre-market. Pretty solid here as we kick off a new week after the worst week since about October. Back in a moment.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
For more on Iran's weekend attack on Israel, let's go to NBC News Chief Foreign Correspondent Richard Engel in Jerusalem. Richard, for an update on what we might see next.
So the Israeli government officially is being very vague on what its responses might be. There was a security cabinet meeting last night, another one today, but no conclusive statements. Israeli officials from the president on down are just saying that Israel will act at a time and place of its choosing. It will act in the interests of the Israeli people. So there are no indications at this moment that a military strike seems imminent. In fact, sources that I'm speaking to do not expect that you're going to see an Israeli strike coming in the next hours or even days. And that's also been reinforced by the fact that late last night, Israel relaxed some of its restrictions that had been put in place. They were supposed to be in effect through the end of the day today, through until 11 o'clock Monday local time here. But those have been relaxed. So that means Israelis are back in school. There can be large gatherings over 1,000 people. So they're trying to signal to the Israeli public that they can relax a little bit. And we are in this unique stage, which is unique in conflict and usually a positive sign, where both sides can claim a degree of success and can claim victory, with Iran saying that it responded to Israel's attack 2 weeks ago on its embassy compound in Damascus that killed 7 people, that it wasn't afraid of Israel, and Israel saying that it succeeded, it was victorious because it rendered Iran's attack with 60 tons of munitions fired at this country ineffective.
Richard, thank you. Richard Engel joining us today from Jerusalem. We continue to watch that. Markets highly attuned to any news regarding the news out of the Middle East. Meantime, the opening bell is coming up in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. Tesla's down in the pre-market. Electric reporting the EV maker plans to lay off more than 10% of its workforce in wake of falling sales. The tech publication cited a company-wide memo from Elon Musk in which he's quoted as saying the cuts are necessary to prepare Tesla for the next phase of growth. Reuters later matched that headline. One of the lines from the email regarding layoffs from Musk says, "There's nothing I hate more, but needs to be done."
Well, if you look at the stock performance year to date, and it continues to fall, questions about EV demand. Tesla's been in the spotlight. We've seen price downgrades or target cuts every single day on this stock. We know they're dealing with something, and after the last delivery update, clearly he's making adjustments.
I saw my first Cybertruck yesterday. I don't know if you guys have seen one on the roads.
They're cool.
Yeah, they are cool.
You clearly do not follow Kim Kardashian on Instagram.
Barreling down, I don't have Instagram, barreling down Broadway. Actually, I did finally get Instagram only because people keep sending me Instagram, so I gotta like have somewhere to look at what they are. But
so pathetic.
I am pathetic. Thank you for that, though, for reminding me. When it comes to Tesla, I mean, the key question continues to be, of course, overall demand, the competition from Chinese EVs that we've talked about. You were at that showroom, Sarah, not very long ago, looking at the quality of those automobiles that compete worldwide with the company. Shanghai obviously continues to be its main factory. I wonder if those layoffs will even include some of the workers there.
It must be very difficult to compete for EVs. Look, we saw a lot of Teslas on the street in Beijing as well, but those showrooms, the Baidu, for instance, Geely, new robocar.
Yep.
I mean, you asked me about quality. They look nice. And it's a competitive market increasingly in Europe where all those Chinese EVs are going.
Let's get the opening bell here in the CNBC Real-Time Exchange. The big board is Fidelity, celebrating the launch of 3 new ETFs. And at the NASDAQ, it is Yahoo Finance. Brett filling in fairly nicely here, trying to reverse some of the losses from last week. Levels, Sarah, 51.61. We'll watch that. We're also watching for arrivals of former President Trump outside the courthouse in Manhattan. I'm not sure. Are we going to take this live? Well, we won't listen in. But the first criminal trial for the former president regarding the hush money, and we'll talk about the implications of whether or not that constituted falsifying business records and election interference. So DJT was down a lot more pre-market.
Yeah, it's a good segue into DJT, which we've been following for some time. Obviously, we were early in sort of discussing with you prior to the de-spacking what it meant on the economic front potentially for the former president who owns some, let's call it 78 million shares right now, due to get another, well, TMTG is due to get another 40 million this week, or maybe it'll be early next week. Remember the 20-day period after the de-SPACing that the stock had to stay above or average 1750 or more? Well, that's going to happen, despite what has been the significant fall in shares. The latest decline is due to an S-1 filing from the company. This is typical of what you get from a company that was acquired by a SPAC or merged with a SPAC. You have a lot of warrant holders, including the sponsors, right? They own common, they also own warrants. And you are going to register those warrants, and that's what this filing is, registering the warrants. And then if and when they actually are exercised, that's what you get. A lot more float. We've made that point any number of times, of course, that what was trading right now, which really was only the shares of the SPAC itself, remember DWAC, is going to be seeing a great deal more shares in the not too distant future when shareholders can actually sell, and that lockup is still some ways away. But more importantly, many of the warrant holders, both private and public, get them registered and then can make a decision as to whether they want to exercise said warrants. $11.50 is the exercise price. Obviously, you can see where they're trading, but with the stock in the mid-20s, many people may choose to sell. Huge profit there. That said, if they believe that the former president is likely to be reelected, and that would perhaps bring great economic benefits to a company that had roughly $4 million in revenues and 50-odd million in losses, well, then they may choose to hold on. But that's what we're dealing with here, guys. Nothing unusual in this, other than it is making it very clear to what may be a largely retail-held stock to some extent that, hey, there's going to be a lot more supply out there. Typically, the SEC takes 3 to 4 weeks to review a registration statement like this. That said, with DJT, you never know.
I do wonder if it's a sort of like real-time gauge of what's happening in the courts, you know, how people are feeling about it. We do have this sort of interesting mark-to-market poll, non-poll in this stock.
Yeah. You know, I just come back to the sort of on the fundamentals. You're going to have some when all the converts and warrants and everything is or the, as everything is sort of counted, some 200 million shares, let's call
more
it.
More shares.
And, you know, 200 million even times the current market value, you can see what that is for a company that, again, has not at this point shown or executed on a detailed plan to be able to have significant revenue growth. Doesn't mean they won't. But that's what I sort of come back to. And again, the former president himself will own some 100 and almost 20 million of those shares.
Which is a lot and helps his
it's a lot.
The financial
it's a lot.
Issues.
Now, again, and then could you push the lockup aside to some extent because he controls the board? And you could get a waiver, it's possible. So that would, to your point, Sarah, allow them to sell. Would he do so in order to just help finance his campaign? It's not unimportant in the context, obviously, of the presidential campaign currently ongoing.
Just looking at this open, it is pretty strong in the market across the board, and the S&P is up almost 0.75%. It's worth noting, Carl, that last week, especially Friday, we saw a pretty broad-based sell-off. 460 stocks in the S&P closed lower, the S&P 500 on Friday. And I thought this stat was interesting. For the first time since September, so the first time all year, every S&P sector was lower on the week. So higher yields in focus, stronger dollar in focus, pushing Fed cuts out in focus and what that's going to do potentially to economic growth. We're having a comeback moment today. Best performing group is financials. That was a hard hit group last week. Today it's Goldman Sachs. That's really the strong story. 5.6%. It's one of the best performers in the S&P. I would also note that M&T Bank is higher by about 5.5% reporting earnings. Schwab is higher by 3%. They also reported earnings. We're going to talk to Walt Bettinger in Money Movers. But again, a lot of these problems that were in focus this time last year, like for Schwab, the cash sorting issues, the deposit worries,
have reversed. They saw deposits go up. They are seeing better numbers and also seeing a lot more trading activity, as Goldman saw, but on the retail side for Schwab, and that's helping out. Stocks up 3%.
As we pointed out, Goldman had what seems to be uniformly reviewed as a very strong quarter, both in investment banking and trading. Its key franchises where it may even have done better than many of its peers, and that stock is up some 5.5%. You see it right there. And to your point, Sarah, I mean, and Carl mentioned this, J.P. Morgan shares just got shellacked on Friday.
6.5%.
In part on what was the guidance from the company in terms of its net interest margin and the like. But we have not seen that kind of bouncing back today, obviously not to the extent of the losses that occurred on Friday.
Meantime, Schwab was in line, I think, on the top and the bottom line. Deposits roughly in line. BAC and Morgan Stanley tomorrow. Later in the week, we'll get some of the Regions and Huntingtons of the world. But be good to talk to Walt and see what the picture's like right now.
And KRE is in focus this week. PNC is coming on Wednesday. We're going to talk to Bill Demchak about that because it's amazing how different of a place we are in now just in terms of sentiment. Although there are still concerns, right? When last week we had rates move up, the KRE got hit really hard because there's still this narrative on Wall Street that the big banks are much better insulated from a more hawkish Fed, higher rates. They do better on net interest margins, partly why there was such a disappointment on the JP Morgan forecast on that front.
Right.
But the regional banks are in weaker shape and they're also more exposed to, say, bad loans or credit issues when you do have these higher rates than just getting the upside on margin.
Yeah. We're taking a look at shares of Apple. And again, remember, Apple shares actually had a very strong week last week because of renewed enthusiasm about what the company may be able to accomplish when it comes to generative AI and the introduction of any number of potential products that may fuel the next generation of iPhones. That said, it is down today on a report from International Data Corp, in which they measure the overall market for smartphones, as they call them, up 7.8% in the first quarter of 24. But Samsung, as you see there, regained its top position in terms of market share. And Apple, which had been at 20.7% in the first quarter of 23 overall, fell to 17.3%. So its year-over-year change was down 9.6%. That seems, Sarah, to be giving some concern to some shareholders, though. Again, the stock has not been a strong performer this year. Nonetheless, it did have a very good week last week on, again, those sort of exuberance around what it may be able to accomplish when it comes to generative AI.
So, yeah, small give back. I just want to point out that the dollar yen is at 154 point. We should just stop the show and take it to Japan right now. Because these are pretty extreme levels, I think, and everybody's watching for, was there going to be some sort of intervention from Bank of Japan? It will impact U.S. earnings. Companies that do business in the U.S. get hurt on the stronger dollar. I mean, that do business abroad. U.S. multinationals, whether you have a big chunk of business over there, you'll feel it. And that this was a tailwind recently as the Fed was going to cut rates and rates were going to come down and the dollar was going to go weak. It's gone completely the other way. And that's been a surprise. And that's going to be another earnings headwind. Not so sure the market punishes companies, though, when they miss on foreign exchange. But they'll be able to use this excuse now.
Nice commentary out of Savita Subramanian and B of A. Just looking at how Q1 guidance is typically the worst of the year. There's no real upside to promising great things for the full year. But it'll be interesting to see how dollar commentary gets folded into some of the qualitative calls from companies today and what they expect. That Procter & Gamble, for example, coming up on Friday.
Absolutely. The guidance is the question because there's been such optimism around earnings with a better GDP and forecasts and prospects for the U.S. economy. But CEOs have sounded more cautious. We picked up on that last quarter. I do wonder where that's going to go this quarter, especially with geopolitics front and center. You know, you continue to hear anecdotally that the new sort of in vogue thing to hear from CEOs is Fed's not going to be able to raise rates this year if they are in a remotely healthy part of the economy and business, IT spending, food spending. Like, unless you're in furniture or some parts of retail, department stores or real estate, which has really been hit off the back of these high rates, it does increasingly look challenging. And today's retail sales numbers make it even harder, showing we have still inflation and we have still a consumer that's willing to spend. We still have an economy that is operating at capacity and also a jobs market that is performing near its potential.
and inflation that's higher than forecast.
I loved Yardeni over the weekend looking at the record net worth among baby boomers, which will be the richest senior citizen generation in the history of the country. And Ed's argument is they're going to spend it all. They're going to spend it all, and that demand for financial services and elderly health care and travel, that's what makes this last mile tough.
That's one of the things. Also, I think back to Larry Fink of BlackRock, who was telling us all these sort of structural factors that's going to make it very hard, that people's roofs, and their parts of their homes are deteriorating
because they've been
living in them for so long, and they're locked into these low mortgages, and that's why you have home insurance rates higher. Auto, more crashes, auto insurance rates higher. I'm just teeing off the demographic trend about what we might be seeing in the data and why it might be hard to have a change.
Spend it all? What do you think, Carl? It's probably a good motto in general.
Who are you going to leave it to? They'll be
why
fine.
Why bother? They'll be just fine. They need to make it on their own. I'm in spend it all mode. I've moved into that mode. Yeah. You guys will be the beneficiaries.
Spend it all. It's tax day, though, so I thought maybe, I don't know, sometimes we see some selling because people have to pay their taxes, but maybe we got that last week.
Although the back half of April for the S&P is generally a little better than the front half because people do get some refunds. What's not playing along today is some tech. CRM's among the S&P laggards. This journal piece, David, on Informatica.
Yeah, would be a fairly large deal for Salesforce. A number of outlets reporting on advanced talks that actually could involve a sale at a price below the current price. The stock of Informatica has moved up rather dramatically of late. Take a look at Salesforce, though, because we have talked a great deal about it over the last year. Remember when they settled with all the different activists and really did go to work on the margins at the company and in part stayed away, at least for the time being, from large M&A. But large M&A has been a key part of what Salesforce has been doing as a company for a very long period of time. The last large deal there was the Slack transaction. And it appears that they may be near doing another deal of some size here. Again, Informatica is a controlled company, so private equity firm Permira and the like took it private, took it public again, but control it at this point.
Is it surprising? I found it surprising to see that Salesforce might be doing another big deal, because weren't they in non-big deal mode for a while?
They were being encouraged by that large group of activists that was involved in the stock in part to focus on execution, focus on getting margins up, Sarah, and to your point, stay away from potentially large M&A. One would expect that if they do move forward with this, they would have socialized it with any number of the, at least in some way. And I should point out Mason Morfitt, of course, from Value Act, is on the board.
Meantime, as Sarah said, all sectors green, VIX below 17. Let's get to Bob Pisani and talk about, Bob, whether the Bulls can hold on to the ball today.
Yeah, look, we've got Middle East concerns mixing with sticky inflation, and that's a very complicated stew for investors. What we have today, obviously, is a bit of a relief rally. All 11 sectors up, 4-1 advancing to declining stocks. Just want to show you some of the sectors that are moving. Obviously, banks higher. Goldman's the leader on the S&P 500 right now, up about 5%. But you see here the reflation trade again doing well here. What's that? Well, that tend to be cyclical stocks, material stocks outperforming, doing well. Freeport MacMoran and Martin Marietta up strong. Industrials like Caterpillar's up 2% right now. Retail strong on the report this morning. The auto names are strong, like Advanced Auto Parts and Group One Automotive. Tech's lagging, obviously, with Apple down a little bit. Interest rate sensitive. Remember, higher rate environment, that's really been messing around with the sector this year. REITs generally, higher rates, not great for REITs overall, because REITs rely on debt financing. Rising rates increase the borrowing costs. Not surprisingly, that is lower this year and underperforming. And utilities generally, rapid rise is not good for them either, because their treasury bonds are more attractive for their higher yields. So higher rates also mean increased borrowing costs for the utilities. Not surprising, utilities also are underperforming this year. Higher rates, again, on this idea of the reflation trade here, in a strong economy, you get cyclicals outperforming. And no surprise, that's exactly what's been happening this year. We keep emphasizing every day. I put up some new highs on energy stocks. Big industrials like Caterpillar, Parker Hannifin have all been strong this year. General Electric have been strong. These are classic deep cyclicals. defensive names, which are traditionally associated with consumer staples names and healthcare, have been underperforming. So again, this reflation trade, when you have a strong economy, higher interest rates can benefit certain sectors over others. We're going to have Jan Van Eck from Van Eck on a halftime report today. He runs a big suite of commodity ETFs, and he'll tell us all about who the beneficiaries are for this reflation trade here. I guess the bigger question is, what could happen? What would be a catalyst for a larger pullback? And to me, 10% is a larger pullback, not 2% like we've seen recently. So you get traditionally three or four things that happen that have to happen in order to get a big pullback. You have to have a slowdown in the economy or job slowdown, notable one. That's not happening right now. An exogenous shock, remember oil embargo in the 70s or COVID or war? Well, unfortunately, that's very elevated right now. We saw those concerns over the weekend. So that's definitely a real concern. And then a rapid rise in interest rates has also been a problem for a correction in the past here. So you can go in all sorts of different directions on this. But the important thing is that interest rate rise doesn't have to come from the Federal Reserve necessarily raising interest rates. Sarah's been talking about this for a while. You could have a series of poor Treasury auctions. You could have a debt downgrade, various things. So in my mind, if you look at the big three things that could cause potentially a notable pullback, two of the three are still very real concerns for the market right now. And I think that's why a lot of people are still on eggshells. Carl, back to you.
All right, Bob. We'll talk a little bit later about Pisani. As we go to break, watch bonds today, of course. We mentioned 10-year above 4.6. Not quite done with data for the morning. We'll get business inventories and NAHB in about 13 minutes. And then Logan and Daly on the tape today as well. Back in a moment.
Samsung, the latest company to secure funding from the CHIPS Act. Let's get to Megan Casella. She's live in Texas and has details of this latest large transaction. Megan.
Hey, guys. So we're here in Taylor, Texas, about 30 miles from Austin. And just behind me, just past these cornfields, is a massive Samsung facility that's about to get a major infusion from the CHIPS Act. The Commerce Department is giving them $6.4 billion in awards. And Samsung is set to invest $45 billion in the next decade. On top of that, to build what they're calling an advanced manufacturing ecosystem. Construction got underway in 2022, but it will now include two leading-edge logic fabs, an advanced packaging facility, and an R&D fab. Officials say this should create some 21,000 jobs within 5 years right here in Taylor. They're mostly going to be in construction, but also in manufacturing. And they'll produce some of the world's most advanced chips to power AI. Now, this is the sixth award coming from the Commerce Department's CHIPS Act. And the Commerce Department does have about $16 billion left to dole out after this. It's hard to really grasp the scale of this project, guys, but take a look at this drone footage to try to get a sense of it. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo told reporters yesterday that each of the two leading-edge logic fabs that Samsung will be building here will be the size of 11 football fields, and that's only one part of the project that will be here. We'll get a chance to talk with her about this investment in an exclusive interview later today on Power Lunch. Guys.
Coming off of the TSM grant and loan from last week about Arizona, it's amazing the ways in which the southern United States economy is changing when it comes to tech.
Absolutely. I think officials here told us yesterday they expect this to be a transformative investment for Taylor. And just driving around here and in Austin, you can see how much development there is, how much money is coming in. The CHIPS Act and some of the Biden administration's other stimulus programs have really been a part of that. And so you can really see that here with the number of cranes that are going up, the amount of new housing that's going up. It's really been a big part of the development here in Texas.
Appreciate that. We're going to get TSM earnings on Thursday. And as it pertains to supply chains around the world, guys like China, Tim Cook in Hanoi today for a couple of days, sort of committing that their supply chain will get diversified probably in the years to come.
Vietnam, I guess, a key part of that. And yep. He was in China a few weeks ago because that's a key demand story and supply.
And obviously India continues to be an important part of their execution as well outside of the Chinese domestic market. Speaking of Apple, those shares are down 1%, defying the overall tone in the market, which is quite positive as we've been seeing for this last half hour. The S&P up some 0.8%, NASDAQ following right along. But there are Apple shares on those market share numbers that we got from IDC. And Tesla shares, interestingly, also down about 3.5%. Oftentimes, when we talk about layoffs from companies, they actually generate a positive response in the market, but not so with Tesla. Perhaps the fears of overall demand sliding for their product are outweighing what may be margin improvement as a result of these layoffs.
Yeah, BP as well, cutting some jobs in their EV unit, trying to get back to different drivers of growth as questions continue to be asked about global demand.
Everybody likes hybrids,
yes.
Right? Toyota.
Hybrids revenge. So holding the opening gains, Dow's at 330 and the S&P 5163. Squawk on the Street continues in a moment. Don't go anywhere. You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.